Good afternoon. My name is Dana. I'm a real alcoholic.
Hey, Dana.
We're going to open this up with a serenity prayer. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. All right. Well, welcome. We're glad y'all are here this afternoon. It's a pretty afternoon to be here, but it's always a good afternoon to talk about making our lives better. And Damon and I did this four-step workshop up at Altoona Roundup about a month ago, and he called me and said, "Let's take it over here for this day." So I'm glad to be here with you guys, and we'll go from there. Go ahead, Damon.
Yeah, my name is Damon. I am an alcoholic, and my sobriety date is the 10th of August 2004. So that's 12 years. So you guys don't have to do the math. This is actually going to be an extended version. When we did this at the Altoona Roundup, we had just enough time to do the resentment part. And this time we have added in the fear and the sex part. Now, this is what we think about sex. This is not the 64 different positions that Joe and Charlie say exist out there. So we're not going to be discussing the 64 different positions. I know that's disappointing some of you, but... what I have on the screen right now, we're using the slides because we're really going to be showing what's in the book, okay? But there's a few things there that requires that you won't necessarily have. And there's some other things, some illustrations that we think might be helpful in understanding about the fourth step. And on the screen right now is our cover, and the cartoon, if you can't read it, it's a man talking on a telephone. That's the thing with the cord on it, if you don't recognize the thing with the cord. So, and there's the wife with the packed suitcase pointing out the door, and the guy's on the phone saying, "Hello, AA, if I join, can I keep at least one resentment?" So what we're going to look at here is, when we kind of looked at that, Dana and I talked about his question was kind of why do we have such trouble doing the fourth step? And my conclusion from all of this is that there's never been an answer to a question why in the history of mankind. You know, I've seen a lot of guys at the jail. They've got years and years to figure out why they keep doing what they're doing. And it's just a bottomless question. But we did come up with a different question. First of all, I need to mention that in this room at one time, anybody ever know Pedro? Did anybody know Pedro? Yeah, back there. Well, Pedro one time told me, he said his sponsor told him, "Don't work the steps." He said, "I want you to just try and stand there and work a step, you know? You need to take the steps." And the idea here is, don't work the steps. That's trying to figure out what this step is going to do for you. Okay, the idea is to take the steps and let the steps do the work. All right? So that's what we're going to be focusing on here, is taking the steps and let the steps do the work. So the first one is, what seems to be blocking us from a thorough fourth step? So that's really the questions that we came up with. And Dana, first one.
Yeah, fear. Then you got apathy. You got guilt and shame. You've got impatience. You've got perfectionism, and you got misunderstanding, and I'm sure you might be able to add to the list as well. There might be some other things, but that was our first thing when we started talking was, well, why don't we do this? What is holding us back? You know, what is this? And these are some of the things we came up with, and Damon, I like what he did. He did all the illustrations, and your mind's closed because you're not keeping an open mind at this time. You know, so for a lot of us that have worked through a four-step or worked on a four-step, there's a lot of these things come up in the beginning, right? But as you open your mind and you start doing them, I think you find out the benefits of working a four-step are far outweigh the negatives that are sitting in front of you.
We can look at fear, and there's a lot of kinds of different fears. Generally, they're related to resentments, which is that somebody's going to take something from me. Somebody's going to actually take something from me I think I own. You know, later on I found out that all the stuff I have owns me because I have to take care of it, right? You got a big house, you got to take care of the house. You got a car, you got to take care of the car. You got to do the insurance. And I try and figure out who owns what, you know. A lot of times you find out that people, you know, in the mystical tradition, what do? They get rid of everything. You know, and as I'm a caregiver for elderly people, and as they grow older, they start jettisoning the stuff. Take this, please take this. I'm tired of taking care of it. So that's kind of an interesting concept on the fear. The other one is that somebody will keep me from getting something that I want or deserve, right? And the other one is somebody will put me in a situation that I can't handle, all right? So that's kind of, to me, that covers a lot of the fears. What about apathy? Do you want me to cover the apathy one?
Yeah, I'll take guilt and shame.
Okay, you're going to handle guilt and shame. Well, apathy says, I really don't care about this four-step thing. You know, what I need is a relationship, you know? And, you know, the idea that they don't see the importance in it. I'm apathetic because I don't see where this is going to benefit me. I have no opinion one way or another. I'm not against the fourth step, but I'm not really in favor of it either. What I really need is a relationship and a bank account. Anybody ever experienced that before, you know, and working with people, you know? They're too busy trying to build their life back together to do a fourth step. So they don't get what's important about it.
Yeah, you know, I don't know if fear is first or fear second or guilt and shame is first, but I find guilt and shame seems to be a big one. You know, I think that, you know, all of us, when we look at our lives and we look at what we did before we came in the rooms of AA and before we started living this life that we're living today, we did a lot of things that we were shameful for. We did a lot of things we had guilt for, you know, and to open that box again and to look at it and to really study it and especially when you don't have the drugs or the alcohol to numb those feelings, you know, it's a big deal, you know. So guilt and shame to me is probably one of the bigger ones next to fear. Go ahead on impatience.
Well, I actually want to touch on the guilt and shame. The idea of shame is God made a mistake when he made me. Okay? Quite frankly, today I'm very grateful today for my ability to feel guilty. I like the guy who came in and he told the sponsor, said, I feel so guilty. He says, well, you are guilty. You know, I was guilty of acting out. I was guilty of doing things that I knew were wrong. Okay? There's a big difference between the shame, which says, you know, God made a mistake when I am a mistake. Okay? And guilt says, I made a mistake. Okay? And I come into this with the concept of sin in the sense of the way the old Greek definition of it was. In the Greek, the word sin comes from an archery term. And literally, archery at that place is they're arching an arrow up into the air to come straight down on top of some guys who are marching towards them in a field with spears and arrows and stuff and trying to kill them. You know? So in order to practice how to hit the arrow at a certain place on the field, they would draw a circle on the field, shoot the arrow, and then they would measure the distance from the center of the circle to where the arrow landed, and that was called the sin. So basically what it is missing the mark. My mama taught me better than this, right? I knew I should be aiming for here, but I consistently miss. Sometimes I actually, on occasions, hit the center, and I was doing okay. I wasn't bad all the time, but I was missing the middle of the mark. And it tells us on page 552, the quote is actually from Chuck Chamberlain, where it says, the only true freedom a human being can ever know is to do what you ought to do because you want to do it. And the idea, I'll put my arm out straight forward like this, and this is what I ought to do. And at right angles to that is what I've been doing. And so much of this new freedom is when I gradually am bringing what I want to do closer and closer to what I ought to do. So with the guilt and shame, first of all, it's recognizing that God did not make a mistake when he made me. And to say, you know, that each and every one of us is capable of behaving well. You know, from one of the great philosophers of the 20th century was Austin Powers. And he said, oh, behave. You know, and isn't that a great message for the alcoholic? Oh, behave. So go ahead, impatience.
Yeah, I mean, today that's one of my biggest character defects is patience. You know? And so I think that we get impatient with and we want to move forward and we want things to happen quickly. And in the process of a four-step, it is a process. You know, it takes time. It takes effort, you know. And what I always talk to my sponsees about, and when I'm going through it, I said, go through it till you're emotionally drained and give it a break. That break may be an hour and maybe 2 hours and maybe a day, but you got to work on it every day. But don't get impatient with it, because it's just, it's part of the process. It's painful. So go ahead on perfectionism.
Yeah, I heard Clancy, who's one of the, it's the most recorded speaker in AA is Clancy, and he said he looked at studies, and we rate very highly on the perfectionist scale. And what I realized was I had an imperfect definition of perfection. I thought that this moment was wrong because it was not the moment I expected it to be. So all you guys got it wrong, okay? Because you're not who I expect you to be. Now that's playing God, don't you think? Isn't that a bit egoic? When I have to start laughing at that definition of perfection that I had. I've come up with a new definition of perfection. This moment is perfectly this moment. If I think otherwise, then I'm thinking God made a mistake when he made this moment. Okay? Each and every one of you are perfectly you at this moment. There's nobody more perfectly you at this moment than you are at this moment. It's true, right? Now, what's perfect about this moment is there's room for improvement. If there was no room for improvement, none of us would have jobs. Right? Do anybody remember seeing the movie WALL-E? Remember that? And they had this spaceship, and all the people were floating around on recliners drinking milkshakes and watching TV all day. There was everything, the machines were doing everything for them, and there was nothing to do. You know, was that perfect? That doesn't look so perfect to me. I like the fact that this world's a little bit off, needs a little bit of help, and gives us something to do every time. So these trophies you see up here, none of these were for the perfect fourth step. Okay, that's not what these trophies are. You know, this idea that I can do a perfect four step, no. You know, the idea is it's a process. But each and every one you do, by definition, is perfect. Because it's the one you did. Okay, so.
Yeah, and misunderstanding too. I mean, you know, for us that have been around or been in the program and spent the time in the program, we understand about a four-step. We understand about this kind of stuff. But if you've never done it, you know, I mean, you read the step up on the wall, and it can be very misunderstanding, as it says up there. And I think that's where it's really, really important to have a sponsor. And a sponsor is nothing more than a guide through the steps. That's what a sponsor's job is. And I think if you work with your sponsor and you have a good sponsor, that's going to alleviate a lot of the misunderstanding as you go through it. Because, you know, we're going to go through it today, and it's all laid out in the book. But the big book is a textbook. It's not a novel. It's designed to be taught out of. So the misunderstanding that you may come into as you work your four-step can certainly be worked through by going through the big book and going through each one of these the way we're going to do it now with a good, competent sponsor.
All right, so what we have on the image right now is sort of this graphic image of a runner. And the message for me on this is what I told a guy over at the work release. And he was saying, when I get out, I'm going to quit. And I said, for God's sake, don't quit. Did quitting ever work for you? Okay. This, because I see these guys and I can quit, but I can only quit for a little bit of time, and then I'll get a little bit restless, I'll get a little bit irritable, I'll get a little bit discontent until I change my mind about quitting. Anybody done that? My whole history, in the end, I was drinking a fifth of vodka a day, and then I'd quit, and I'd brush myself off and feel pretty good, and then I'd go along, and then it'd be that little thing, the way the wife looked at me, this little thing, can't get the job I wanted, until the pressure builds up like a pressure cooker. You know, and then all of a sudden, drink. I got to drink, you know. And, you know, one, you know, just a little, just to take the edge off, I need a little relief. And then it starts. What I need to do is to start adopting a design for living that does not include drinking. There's a very big difference. I want to be a good father. Look down on the list of being a good father. Drinking is not in the list. I want to look down and be a good husband. Drinking is definitely not on the list, you know. Coming up on our 37th year of marriage, you know. I like the guy who said we never decided to divorce each other at the same time, you know. And but it's this idea of starting. Don't quit. In fact, the book doesn't say quit. If I was going to write a book on not drinking, I'd say step one, stop drinking. Isn't it amazing? The book doesn't say step one, stop drinking. Because Bill knew us. He knew we can't stop. We're powerless over alcohol. That means I can't quit, but what I can do is seek God, right? God could and would if he were sought. So this first section, it says, this is right after the third step prayer. And Dana, you want to go ahead and read it?
Yeah, we launched out on a course of vigorous action, the first step of which is a personal house cleaning, which many of us have never attempted. Though our decision was a vital and crucial step, it could have little permanent effect unless at once followed by strenuous effort to face the and to be rid of the things in ourselves which were blocking us. Our liquor was but a symptom, so we had to get down to causes and conditions. And when I look at that and I think about it, and the first thing that I think about here is that it says here vigorous, and that means with a lot of action. And then it says this decision was vital, and vital is necessary for life. Right now, if I fall on the floor and y'all call a paramedic and they get over here, the first thing they're going to check is my vital steps, vital signs, because they're necessary for my life. So it's necessary for life. And then it says it can have little bit permanent effect unless followed by strenuous effort to face and be rid of the things that are blocking us. And the things that it's blocking us from is blocking us from the sunlight of the Spirit. It's blocking us from God. These are the things that are blocking us from God, and that's why we've got to get rid of them. And the last piece of it, it says our liquor was a symptom. We had to get down to causes and condition. Liquor's the symptom. That's what we use to figure out and to feel a different way. But what's really going on? What's the cause? What makes us drink and use like that to feel? You know, what is it? You know, what are the things that are doing that? And that's the causes and conditions of it. So that's what I have on that, Damon. Go ahead.
Yeah, and the causes and conditions for me, you know, I talk about there's never been an answer to a question why. I love the way Bill pairs up causes and conditions. Each and every one of you drank for a different reason. I like this guy who said, yeah, let's say that the reason I drank was because my mom had a square nipple and she potty trained me sideways. Now, what am I going to do with that information? You know, I cannot do anything with that information to improve my life. Now, if I know causes and conditions, see, then I can look at under what conditions do I get restless, irritable, and discontent, which by a neat coincidence are the initials for RID, R-I-D. So what I need to do is I need to look at those conditions, and I need to watch out for those conditions where I get restless, irritable, and discontent, and then I can apply one of these tools that we're learning in the fourth step in order to take the pressure down so I don't get to the point where I change my mind about not drinking. Okay, so now we've got a big sign up there saying bankrupt. And therefore, we started on a personal inventory. Anybody here ever done an inventory at a business or where you've gone? Okay. Now, you don't catalog what you feel about the boxes on the shelf, right? We just put down enough about what's on the shelf to be able to describe it to someone else. So that's what's beautiful. Bill's a businessman. He understands what an inventory is, you know, and it's not how we feel emotionally about the box and how, you know, what we went through to get it on the shelf or anything like that, you know, and why we're so attached to having it on the shelf, even though it's dusty and of no use. So this was step four. A business, now we're going to do a metaphor. Bill is great about teaching with metaphors, okay? When I look at, you know, he talks about Jim putting the whiskey in the milk and the jaywalker, you know, and the people on the shipwreck. So this, and, you know, Jesus taught in parables for a reason too, because when we talk about a parable and we tell a story, each and every one of you will get something different out of that story. And that's the beauty of it. Rather than saying this is what you should get out of it, he just gives it that way. So he's given an analogy of this as a business inventory versus a personal inventory, so you can get more out of it, actually. So a business which takes no regular inventory usually goes broke. Well, that in a person, broke for a business is dead. We go back to the vital, you know, part of it. So taking a commercial inventory is a fact-finding and fact-facing process. So this is about truth. We're going to be trying to look for the truth. Just what are the facts? Just looking at the facts, not how we feel, but just what are the facts, and be able to face them. And if we've made the decision in step three that we have a new employer being all-powerful, he provides what we need as long as we stay close to him and perform his work well, then I have no fear, I don't have any reason to fear looking at the facts, because he's got my back. That's why the third step is such a vital decision to make, because it makes it very difficult to do this step if I'm going to have to face these facts alone. So it's an effort to discover the truth. There's again the truth about the stock and trade. Now, the stock and trade that I have is a set of habits and how I respond to life, to different life situations. That's my stock and trade. How, you know, if anybody ever told you you had not responded appropriately, you ever get that idea? You know, learning about how to respond appropriately, what so much of this is about. So one object is to disclose damaged or unsalable goods to get rid. There's our rid again. To get rid of them promptly and without regret. Regret for me is going back into my past and changing one variable. I'll give you an example. If I'd have quit 8 years ago, 8 years before I actually did, I'd have kept that really big job. I'd been gotten a new car, had the whole family in it, driving along, pulled out in front of a tanker truck, it exploded, and we all burned to death. Now, wait a minute. That is not the way you play Happily Ever After. There's rules to Happily Ever After, right? You go dancing off into the tulips, right? No, but reality is the unexpected. Everything about it's unexpected. Things unexpected happen in reality. So for me to go back and regret the past is playing God. You get it? I'm arranging the lights, the scenery, the ballet, and the rest of the players in just such a way that I get to go dancing off into the tulips. And that's why we don't regret the past nor wish to shut the door on it. We don't regret because I'm playing God when I do it. And so that's why I can do it without regret now. If the owner of the business, me, is to be successful, he cannot fool himself about values. Dana.
Yeah, when I get in this book, I talk about pinto mufflers. Who's been in a book study and I've talked about pinto mufflers before? So y'all said, what does pinto mufflers have to do with this? And if you think about it like this, if I have a muffler shop, right, and I have a muffler shop, and, you know, you go in like it's like a Napa Auto Parts or something, and you got your counter, and then in the back you got all these mufflers hanging up, right? And a guy comes in, and he's got a 2007 Toyota Camry, and he says, I'd like a muffler for this 2000 Toyota Camry. And you go in there, and he goes in the back, and he's looking through all these pinto mufflers, and he doesn't have room to hang a muffler for this 2000. So he says, look, I don't have it. You're gonna, and he goes to the muffler shop up the street. Same thing happens over again. Guy comes in with a Ford Taurus and needs a muffler. If he doesn't take a look at his business, if he doesn't look and say, these pinto mufflers have absolutely no value to me, they're causing me to lose business, then he's going to go broke. And it's just like us. If we're working on our four step, you know, our four step is looking at our character defects, finding out the things that are blocking us from the sunlight of the spirit. They're our pinto mufflers. You know, those are our pinto mufflers, and we've got to get rid of those things. And it's no different. So it's funny. Last Christmas, I was away with my family, and I get a text, and it doesn't say anything on it. All it is a picture of a light blue pinto out in this field somewhere, rusting down to nothing with just a happy face on it. So I always think about that. So I like the pinto muffler story. So no more pinto mufflers for you. Go ahead.
Next page. All right. So we've got a hand with a pen checking off excellent, good, average, and poor. And Dana, why don't you go ahead and read this one?
We did exactly the same thing with our lives. We took stock honestly. First, we searched out the flaws in our makeup which caused our failure. Being convinced that self manifested in various ways was what had defeated us, we considered its common manifestations. And, you know, self will run riot. I mean, y'all have heard, I'm sure somebody's told you that before, right? You know, your self will run riot. And it manifests itself in a ton of different ways in my life. And when I came in here, if you'd have told me I was selfish, I would have said, no, not me. You know, I help these people out. I do this. But when I really look at it, it was always about me. I always set these things in motion and then got a resentment against me when you didn't react towards me the way I expected you to react towards me. You know, and go ahead. That's all I got with that, unless you got something, Damon.
It's really, but manifest, by the way, on a ship, the manifest is a list of what's on hand in the ship, okay? And it actually comes from a Latin manna that has to do with in hand, has to do with the hand. So I have what Joe and Charlie, I think, say it pretty well when they say what I have is these instincts of life, you know, for security, for safety, for you know, for companionship, for, you know, self, all these different things. When they get out of hand, okay, and I become selfish and I start, all my actions have to do with satisfying those wants and needs, then it manifests itself in bad relationships most all the time. It manifests itself in fear. Okay, it manifests itself in trying to manipulate other people as a means to an end, to try and get them to do something for me. So this is saying that these instincts gone awry, living my life on instincts rather than living them on principles, is going to manifest itself, and that means it's going to be situations in my life that I see. And we're going to describe those situations, and we're going to call them resentments, we're going to call them fears, and we're going to call them the sex inventory. Okay, next. All right, and this one we have a very angry, happy face down at the bottom of the screen here. So this resentment is the number one offender. It destroys, which is another death word, right? Destroys more alcoholics than anything else. Now, resentment is, if you can break it down into what it means, the RE is like instant replay. They play it over and over again. The S-E-N-T comes from a centauri, which is Latin, and it really means to relive, to live, okay? Like sentient being. You've heard of, you know, like we're looking for other sentient beings. And M-E-N-T always means a state of being. So a state of being where I'm constantly reliving something. It's not just refeeling it, but it's actually going back and rehearsing it, doing the resentment, right? Changing. You know how when I do the resentment, that person always gets more and more wrong, and I get more and more right. Anybody else had that? Because as I'm constantly, this is the idea about going back and finding out the facts. And that's why I need another person to look at it, because I've told myself the story so many times, I believe something that's not true. So that's why it's important to have a guide here. So from it stem all forms of spiritual disease, for we have been not only mentally and physically ill, we have been spiritually sick. Now here's one of the great promises in the whole book for me. And this is what it says: when the spiritual malady is overcome, we straighten out mentally and physically. We got a 3-for-1 sale. How's that? So this, you know, the whole purpose of the book is to help you find a power greater than yourself that will solve your problem. If I get the spiritual right, if I get right with you and I get right with God, and I take this attitude that I have a new employer who provides everything I need, all of a sudden, why do I need to have fear? See, fear is like this fist. See the fist? See that? Where'd it go? See, I open up my hand and it's gone. It's sort of like, where does run go when you stop running? It's a nonsensical question. So when I start trusting, fear goes, it disappears. It's gone. It just doesn't exist for us. On 85, 84 and 85, we talk about that, right? You know, that's the miracle of it. You know, we haven't even sworn off. It's just gone. As a process of this. So it's not something that's going to be permanently there that I have to deal with all the time, you know, like a stump out in the yard, you know. It's something that just goes when I change my behavior. So we finish, and it says, love that line, so we listed people, institutions, or principles with whom we were angry. I like that anger is the inability to control another person's actions, you know. And it also, anger is a form of fear. We ask ourselves why we were angry. Fortunately, Bill gives us the answer. In most cases, it was found that our self-esteem, our pocketbooks, our ambitions, our personal relationships, including sex, were hurt or threatened. So we were sore, we were burned up. And that guy looks burned up, doesn't he? So, go ahead, Dan.
Yeah, I mean, we've taken this out of the big book. I mean, this is straight out of the big book. And when you get to your 4-step, it tells you what to do. It's real quick. Resentments, we set them on paper. We listed institution, principles, and people who were angry. That's your first column. It's right there. And then it goes here. It says we ask ourselves why we're angry. There's your second column. You know, it's right there. And then your third column here is, you know, we found out that our self-esteem, pocketbooks, etc., were burned up. So, you know, going back to what we were talking about misunderstanding a little bit earlier, you know, I could read over that real quickly and miss how important that is. You know what I mean? That's why you go through this with somebody who's been through this book and who's been a sponsor and done this kind of work before, and we're going to talk a little bit about this later on how we lay these out, because there's different people that use worksheets for it, and Damon and I was interesting when we started talking about doing this. We met over at my office, and you know, he has a different way of doing things, not a whole lot different than me, but it's different. And I'm not saying that the worksheets are bad or good or whatever. There's arguments for all of them. But at the end of the day, that goes back to the important thing is to do it. But if we're teaching out of the big book and this is what we're talking about, there's your first column, your second column, and your third column.
So what we're going to look at next is this is where it says, on our grudge list, we set opposite each name or injury. Was it our self-esteem, our security, our ambitions? This is actually Bill relisting everything except one word in there. Our personal or sexual relationship, and he says in there, our security. And security was not one of the ones that was listed previously. Now, it is a combination of several other things, you know, and it is a basic, you know, basic instinct of life. You know, it's probably one of the most basic is our security. But he's listing it here, so it becomes, there's a couple of different ways. He's giving you more suggestions here, which had been interfered with. We were usually as deafened as this example. Now, on here, I've got this happy pencil, you know, and that's kind of the way your sponsor would like for you to look at the at you doing the four-step. And then it's got a gun pointed at his head, you know, which is, I think, this dichotomy between the way that the sponsee is looking at it. You know, you look so happy about doing this four-step, but I am not happy at all about getting ready to do this because I don't understand it. You know, I'm fearful of it. Don't you understand what I've done? You don't even know. You haven't heard all of the things I haven't told you yet, et cetera, et cetera. But on this list is basically the layout of the three columns with the I'm resentful at, the cause, and the effects my. And Dana, you want to go through them?
Sure. Mr. Brown, he's a peach. All right. Mr. Brown, I'm resentful at Mr. Brown. He has attention to my wife, and it affects my sex relations and self-esteem and fear. Told my wife I had a mistress. What's his problem? What's his deal? And it affects his sex relations and self-esteem. Brown may get my job at the office. Security, self-esteem, fear. Fear bracketed by all of them. Mrs. Jones, she's a nut. She snubbed me. She committed her husband for drinking. He's my friend. She's a gossip. Affects his self-esteem, personal relationship, self-esteem, and fear. My employer, unreasonable, unjust, overbearing, threatens to fire me for drinking and padding my expense account. Why would they do that? I don't understand. Affects my self-esteem and my fear and insecurity. My wife, she misunderstands and nags, likes Brown, wants to put the house in her name. Pride, personal, sex relationships, and security and fear. And, you know, everybody's going to have something different up there unless you know Mr. Brown personally, but outside of that, everything's going to be a little bit different in here. But when I look at it, I always look at this word right here, fear, and fear is behind everything, you know. And I think if right now if we sat down and we worked on some four steps together, all of us did together, and we started writing them out, I guarantee you that we would all come back with pride, personal relationship, sex relationship, security, and fear, and self-esteem. Those would all fall into our column because we all have those where it's a characteristic of an alcoholic. It would fall into those things. And the big one for me was fear, and the second one was self-esteem because I was an egomaniac with an inferiority complex, and I never felt good about myself. And all it took was somebody to do something a little odd to me, a little something that I found objectionable, and my self-esteem just shattered, you know. So great layout for how it starts. And go ahead, Damon, did I miss anything?
No, I think you did. We're going to look at the next slide, and this slide is just two different kind of images of different kinds of forms. You'll find a lot of different forms out on the web. Your sponsor may is going to have something different they're going to show you. I don't think the form is so important, really. As long as it includes these basic things that we're looking at. And one of these is from Atlanta Men's Workshop. Another one is one that Joe and Charlie did. So there are just different ones out there. Personally, what I like to do is to have people actually pull out the layout of the form. What I do is I just have them get a spiral notebook. Just, you can get them down at the dollar store. And to open it up, so it's really an 11 by 17 page, you know. And so it forms one big long page. And then what I begin to do, and this is just the blank page, and I'm going to just start drawing the lines in it. You know, draw a line, you split the left-hand side into two halves, and you split the right-hand side into two halves, leaving more on that right part. It's actually, we just sort of draw these lines. So we're going to wind up with five columns here. This is just the way I like to do it, and I'll show you what the reasoning is behind that. So the first thing I've got is people, institutions, and principals with whom are angry. That's in the first column. And the second column I put is the cause, in quotes. And I like this guy that says 20 words or less, because that's all Mr. Brown gets. You know, he was a pretty heavy resentment right there. Because this isn't about an autobiography, you know, it was a cold and stormy night. No, that's not an inventory. Right. This is just enough of a story, and you don't need to make a. You don't need to put down enough so that you can make a case to keep the resentment. Okay. I don't think the sponsor is going to let you keep the resentment. So it doesn't matter how good a case you make. It could stand up in a court of law, and AA says you don't get to keep no resentments on. Okay. Because they're killing us. Number one offender. Right. So all it is enough of the description, so just like a box on the shelf, you're going to describe enough about the box that you can communicate it to somebody else, and that's all you need to do. So it can keep it fairly short. With the effects my is the third column. And now the way Dana likes to lay it out is where he puts, just like in that end on page 65, where he lays it out and he writes out by hand each one of those, and he repeats fear on it. He'll repeat self-esteem over and over again with the idea that it burns it into their memory, right?
Yeah, when I did my four-step, I wrote down anger, jealousy, fear, self-esteem. I wrote them down, every one of them, and I'll never forget it. My hand hurt. I was writing fear so much, you know, but now I know, you know, and Damon, when he said what he does, he kind of helps show by using the charts, and
I'll
get into that.
Yeah, I'll show you in just a second, yeah.
You know, I got it, you know what I mean? So is there a wrong way or right way? No, there isn't. It was just a different way, you know, but the key to all of it is to go back to we just do it. You know, we've just got to make sure we do it.
So the way I like to lay it out is I actually make a series of columns under the effects my. I just put these little letters, E for self-esteem, a dollar sign for pocketbooks, an A for ambition, an R for personal relations, the X for sex relations, an S for security, and P is for pride, because if you look down in those three columns on 65, Bill sneaks another one in on us. He sneaks the word pride, and he hadn't listed that in the two paragraphs before. So I just put it on there and say, what we can do then is just draw a series of lines, and what I like to do is use check marks inside the lines. And it's almost like the movie The Matrix, where you can sort of see this pattern of check marks, and you can see that you got a whole lot of check marks in the self-esteem boy. You know, I can visually see. And I like it as a sponsor because when I look at the page, I can look at it just as a quick glance and go, oop, that's showing up a lot right there. So it's just a different way of doing it. And then also what I show is that we begin to number the left-hand side. And what I like to do on the notebook is to write a number one, skip two lines, write the number two, skip two lines, write the number three. And do that initially when you're writing the people, because then you don't get a lot of room to put the cause in that starts off with the dark and stormy night thing. Okay? So now this is where we come into, go ahead, Dana, you can read this one. This is a little, almost a Gumby kind of thing, just looking at his hands, very bewildered.
We went back through our lives. Nothing counted but thoroughness and honesty. When we were finished, we considered it carefully. The first thing apparent was that this world and its people were often quite wrong. To conclude that others were wrong were as far as we ever got. The usual outcome was that people continued to wrong us and we stayed sore. Sometime it was remorse, and then we were sore at ourselves. But the more we fought and tried to have our own way, the worse matters got. As in war, the victor only seemed to win. Our moments of triumph were but short-lived. And, you know, it's a new way of life. It's, you know, in the beginning of the big book, it talks about recreating our lives. And that's what we're doing here. We're not stopping using. We've got to stop using, but we're trying to recreate our lives. And, you know, I never, ever, ever looked at my part in an argument. You know, it was this, a lot of finger pointing. And I never thought about, how did I get this thing going? How did I set this ball and rolling? And it's just that psychic change they talk about in the big book, a spiritual awakening, a spiritual experience. It's a psychic change. It's a change of thinking. And I think you do that when you start looking at this. Well, yeah, I got angry with this one, but did I set this expectation? And that's a big one for me, is expectations. Did I set an expectation on somebody, and then when they didn't do what I wanted them to do it, or do it the way that I wanted them to do it, then all of a sudden what happens is I get resentful at you. But I'm the one that set up the expectation for you. So, you know, and then I love it here, and sometimes we're remorseful and sore at ourselves. Yeah, sometimes you just can't blame anybody else. I mean, you know you're the one, you know, and but it's still, it only seems that you win. I don't know about you all, but whenever I've been in an argument, and whether it's at work or at home or whatever, or with my child or anything like that, and it seems like I've won the argument, it still feels bad. You know what I mean? Because there's no winner in that situation. It's just a bunch of negative going around. And then we're going to, you know, and in recovery, we look at healthy ways to solve solutions. So anyway, that's what I have with that, Naaman. If you got anything, go ahead.
Yeah, I think what we're talking about, the first three columns will do you no good, especially if you do them left to right, the way we always do, go in the bar, this so-and-so did this to me, and I lost $1,000. Okay, go back to the next one on the list, and they did this to me, and I lost. If you just stay in 1, 2, and 3, that's the sickness right there. So one of the things we do differently and suggest to do differently is that we list the people, principles, and institutions. And by the way, the example of the principle that I had a resentment to was monogamous marriage. Okay, you know, why couldn't I live in a country that, you know, allowed other kinds of marriage arrangements? I had to live here where there was this one. You know, now I find it to be it's really the greatest thing about my life. You know. And it's just a beautiful thing to be a partner with someone. So this idea is that if I'm just living in those first three columns, that's my illness. So this whole thing about looking at it in an entirely different way is about to come up. So on the next slide, we've got a symbol of a broken chain. And when we talk about in the third step prayer that to relieve me of the bondage of self, that bondage for me is a chain of thoughts and a chain of feelings. And I need to do something to break the chain. Okay? It's a feedback loop that feeds back on itself, so I need to do something different. So it's plain that a life which includes deep resentments leads only to futility and unhappiness. Is that plain? You know? So I don't want to keep hold of them. Once I'm convinced of this, and Bill uses that word a lot, not only about getting convinced, but staying convinced. So to the precise extent that we permit these, I love that idea. You mean the resentments are not foisted upon me? You mean I'm not forced to have this resentment? No, I have a permit, like a zoning permit for resentments. I'm allowing them to happen. That's the amazing part about it. And it says, do we squander the hours that might have been worthwhile? How many hours do you think you've spent in your life nursing resentments? Would you like to get $1 an hour for that? Would that be pretty good pay? Isn't that amazing? And it's a squander because it doesn't do anything. You know, I keep thinking the next time I see the person, boy, I'll win that argument, then I'll get it. You know, and what I find out in 37 years of marriage is winning is way overrated. Just like he said, I never feel the way I think I should feel when I win. I don't want to win. We have ceased fighting anything and anyone, and Bill talks about that. So, but with the alcoholic whose hope is the maintenance and growth of a spiritual experience, serious question, is that your hope? Or do you just want the bigger house? Do you want your family to treat you a certain way? Do you want your job to be, everybody at your job to be nice to you? Do you want your kids to be all well-behaved? Is that it? Or is this really the goal? The growth and maintenance of a spiritual experience. See, when that becomes my goal, to move in the presence of God, a God I don't even really understand, that becomes the main motive, then it changes the whole deal. Instead of trying to arrange life to suit myself such that I get the conditions right for me to be happy, did you ever get the conditions just right? Were they ever enough? The disease of alcoholism for me is the disease of not enough, right? And the solution is I'm swimming in abundance. I'm in a planet in this perfect place, you know, amazing place in this incredible universe with all these beautiful waterfalls and things all around, and the cities are even beautiful, all the stuff. I'm in a totally different way of looking at it. I'm at the mixture of the zoo and the amusement park and the, you know, and all these places I get to go explore today. Because it's an experience. The whole thing about being alive today is an experience. It's not something I have to go through. It's something I get to do. See, that's that. When that is my goal, then all of a sudden I don't need to keep them, because I don't care if they're blocking me from getting a new car. Though it doesn't matter, because that's what I want is the experience. That's goal one. That's the whole deal. This business of resentment is infinitely grave. I love that business. Not a pastime. Bill uses it somewhere else. He says, our drinking careers have been characterized by countless vain attempts to prove we could drink like other people. He uses careers twice in the big book. You get to find it the other places. But we've at least twice, maybe one more. But so we find that this business of resentment is infinitely grave. That's another kill you word, you know. We found that it is fatal. Boy, he's really hitting it here, isn't he? I think he's serious about this thing with the resentments. So, for when harboring such feelings, oh, another metaphor, but a beautiful metaphor, ships in a harbor. I have these resentments. I'm stroking them. I'm painting them, scrubbing down the decks, making sure the holes are out of all of the sails, you know, restocking them with armor. So next time my resentment goes out to do battle to win the argument, you know, that it has a chance of surviving because I'm harboring these resentments. I'm protecting them because I think they're doing something for me. The shields are up, Scotty. Get the idea? But you know what? Those are really bars. And they're encaging me and locking me in. I was drinking, isolated in my house, cut off from the rest of the world. I do a lot of jail meetings, and I'm the guy who built my own jail. I lock myself in my own world by this way. So the resentments are not my friend. They're not protecting me in any way. See, that's one of the great illusions, that my resentments, I don't want to let go of them because they're protecting me. They're my shields, but they're not. They're my bars for my own prison. So when harboring such feelings, we shut ourselves off from the sunlight of the Spirit. How can I have a resentment and a deep relationship with God at the same time? I don't know that it's possible. The insanity of alcohol returns and we drink again. It doesn't say we drink again and the insanity of alcohol returns. The insanity of alcohol for me is if I ever think that I can successfully drink again before I take alcohol into my body. Right? So the insanity of alcohol was not when I drank. It's when I decided to drink again. And that's crazy. Because I don't have a recent history of being successful. And with us, to drink is to die. We got another one out there. So the final paragraph on this one is, if we were to live, we had to be free of anger. That doesn't mean I need to cope with my anger. I need to deal with my anger. It means, just like the fist, I want it to be gone. Okay? Gone. And that's possible. Within this program, it's possible. Now, this is the grouch and the brainstormer, not for us. My family's got a 1937 dictionary. And in that dictionary, brainstorm is defined as essentially lightning and thunder in the brain. That it came about to sit around a table and talk about ideas came from Walt Disney around that time. So let's not mix that up with the terms. This is a 1937 brainstorm. So what's the grouch? I like it being described as the slow burn. You know, the sort of, I got a dog that she doesn't get her dog biscuit if she doesn't go outside. And when I close the gate, the door on her crate, I hear this, this little rumble, you know. It's grouchy because she doesn't get her dog biscuit. But the brainstorm is the other side. That's rage. That's the slamming the hand into the laptop, okay, because it's not doing what I want it to do. They may be the dubious luxury. Dubious means of doubtful value. And a luxury is something that's more expensive and I don't really need it. Right? So this is a double don't need it kind of thing. And something I can't afford. So a dubious luxury of normal men, but for alcoholics, these things are poison, which is another death word. Dana?
I mean, you brought it up. I mean, just this is not even two full paragraphs, and they got words in there like die and infinitely grave and fatal and you know, there's some serious strong words in there associated with not doing this work, you know, and I really like to point that out. But one thing that Damon touched on where it says the insanity of alcohol returns, and insanity in the rooms of AA, a lot of people say it's doing the same thing over and over again and expecting different results, and I guess that's a definition. But for me, I use insanity as not being able to differentiate the truth from the false. And it's constantly believing that lie. And so if I believe that lie again, I'm just going to have one. It's going to be different this time. They'll never know. I'll be able to control and enjoy it. Whatever that lie is, that insanity of alcohol returns again and we drink. So that's all I got with that.
On the insanity, Bill gives us a definition of insanity when Jim puts the whiskey in the milk. He gives us two definitions in there. And it's kind of a funny paragraph, but he says this lack of proportion. Given all of the things that I've got, want to be a good father, a good husband, all of that, then the idea that my problem in wanting to drink is this big and my family is this little tiny pea of an idea over here. That's a lack of proportion. What I need to do is I need to have God and the good life, and the way I need to be living is huge. And these little things people are doing, it's just small stuff. They have a problem, and I wish them well, you know, kind of thing. And that's about getting a proportion. The second part is the inability to think straight. I've come to the conclusion my thinking was not my problem when I was drinking. My thinking was pretty good as long as it was not interrupted by my feelings. You know what I'm saying? If I didn't have any feelings involved, if I was just working on a program or something, I could do that program. But when I thought somebody was thinking bad of me, or what's that person doing, or they're going to finish their part of the program before I finish my part of the program, and I got to show them up, and I got to do that, and it messed up my ability to think straight. You see what I'm saying? I like what Ann Smith, Dr. Bob's wife, she kept a journal from 1933 to 1939 and in the Oxford group, and she said something amazing. She said, "Feelings are the fruit, not the root of my faith." So the idea is instead of acting on my feelings, I act on principles. And at the end of the day or after I've done the action, I can reach up and pluck the succulent fruit of a day well spent. I harvest my feelings. I do not act on them. When I act on my feelings, feelings are the physiological reaction of the body to a thought. And they have a machine to measure it. It's called a lie detector. And they hook you up to a lie detector, and they ask you questions, and the mind thinks, oh, wait, you know, and then the body senses that, and then the react, you know, the little pins start going up and down, and then you see that, and then you get this feedback loop, like if I took the microphone and put it up to the speaker, you know, this runaway deal. So we need to, again, break the chain of those feelings and stop acting on my feelings. I used to think it was a cruel thing for the old timers to tell me, I don't give a damn how you feel. I found out it's the best advice I've ever been given, that I don't give a damn how I feel, because they're going to change. What am I doing? And what I'm doing, is it based on principles? Next page, we have a hand holding a glass orb that's given a sort of an upside down view of the world through it. And Dana, you want to read that one?
We turned back to the list, for it held the key to the future. We were prepared to look at it from an entirely different angle. We began to see that the world and its people really dominated us. In that state, the wrongdoing of others, fancied or real, had the power to actually kill. How could we escape? We saw that resentments must be mastered. But how? We could not wish them the way any more than alcohol. And, you know, we've got our list in front of us, and I love it. It's the key to the future, because when you take a look at your four step and then you do your fifth, sixth, and seventh, and you get rid of your character defects, that is your future. That's the past. It has no value. You know, that absolutely has no value anymore once you do your four step, except that you've got your list for your eight step, and you may want to refer to it when you're working with others or something like that. And I never, and I'm guilty of it today. You know, I the world dominates me sometimes. When I'm not catching enough meetings, when I'm not praying enough, and I'm not doing this stuff, I get in that fear mode again. and I get in that low self-esteem mode again, and that dominates me again. I don't feel like I'm good enough, and I have to watch out for that. And it does have the power to. It's fancier to real. I love that too. You know, I mean, my first addiction was fantasy. You know, it was a lie. You know, I just believed that Twinkle Toes and all this stuff, it was a fantasy world. It wasn't real. I never lived in the real world until I came into AA and started looking at my life and living the way that I feel like I need to live. And how can we escape? You know, we can escape by doing these steps. We can escape by living the principles. We can escape by doing the things that we need to do in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous to escape this stuff. And then it says, we saw these resentments had to be mastered, but how? We couldn't wish them away more than we could of alcohol. You know, I remember very clearly a lot of times saying to myself and meaning it, y'all, meaning it from the bottom of my heart, I am not going to use tomorrow. I'm going to get high tonight, and I'm not going to use tomorrow. And I meant it. And you know what I mean? And I really meant it. But my willpower was not strong enough. I was not strong enough. My will, I was not strong enough. And that's why I rely on this higher power. And it's the same thing with these character defects. You know, I don't want to be self-centered anymore. I don't want to have low self-esteem. I don't want to be racked with fear anymore. Well, it just doesn't work that way. You know, that's what God's for. That's what we work on 6 and 7 so hard on, you know, is getting rid of these character defects. And, you know, we're not working on the seventh step right now. But, you know, one of the things that I do when I do my 7-step prayer, even today when I find these things that I identified in my 4-step, okay, identified them in my 4-step as character defects, they creep up on me again. I actually call them out in my 7-step prayer. It says, you know, I'll say, that I'll talk about remove every single defect of character. And for me, a big thing that I've been working on always is fear, and second is judgmental, you know. And I ask God to help me not be so judgmental and so racked with fear anymore. And so I've got to have God's help to get rid of these things, because I can't wish them away. If I could wish them away, I wouldn't have to do this stuff. So go ahead.
The one thing I have is, how can we master them? The greatest tool in my toolbox, forgiveness. I like Sandy Beach. He says, why do we choose forgiveness last? Sandy Beach is a guy who, in December of 2009, he did a talk on the 10th step inside the 12 and 12. And he was talking about the spiritual axiom that whenever I'm disturbed, there is something wrong with me. And that next year, when my mom was dying of cancer at that time, and I decided not to grieve over her cancer, because who am I to know? And how do I know that that's not exactly what needs to happen? And as a result, I also realized that if I am worried about my mother, I will become part of her problem, because she'll worry about me worrying about her, and she had no doubt about where she was going. You know, so she had, and what was happening is that her material body started to disappear, and the things that she could do, her spiritual started to rise. And as I started to do this program, my spiritual experience was coming on, and I got to connect with my mom at a level that I am so blessed that that happened at that time. I'm very grateful for that. And, you know, it was really one of the great experiences of my life. And what actually happened, and I'll just quickly share this, is at the viewing, we're in the room with the open coffin, and my vehicle my mom rode around in is in there, and I had my guitar there because my mom always liked to have the guitar. And this lady came from her church and had this little 4-year-old girl maybe on her shoulder, just clinging to her. You can't have fun at a funeral. And I said, can I sing you a song? And the mother went, yeah, and the girl went, no, but okay. So I sang Marvelous Little Toy, you know, and then Baby Beluga in the Deep Blue Sea. And the little girl got down and said, you know, 5'2", eyes of blue, and then don't mess with my blue suede shoes. And she's just dancing right there in the room with the coffin, you know. My mother's natural state of being was one of being of service. That's what she would have wanted me to do. Not to grieve over her loss, but to carry on her example. So I was able to forgive her disease, forgive that. Do you understand? It's about that. It's about, it's, it seems like it's unnatural, but yet it became the most natural thing I could do. So how do we master this? This is this was our course. We realized that the people who wronged us were perhaps spiritually sick. That doesn't mean they were spiritually sick. It just means perhaps. And I like what Bill says in page 164. We realize we know only a little. What I think you're thinking of me right now is not what you're thinking of me. What I think you've been through in your lives is not what you've been through in your lives. It's a little tiny story I tell myself, and it can't be true. Okay, it can only be a very bare, close approximation. Okay, so whatever, and all these resentments are based on stories I tell myself of what I think other people are thinking about me, what I think they've done, what I think their motives are, all of this, and it's make-believe, it's twiddle-dee, you know, back there. So though we did not like their symptoms, you know, of the spiritual sickness they have, and the way these disturbed us, of course, no one can really disturb me. They can't reach through my ear canal and press a button that says you're disturbed. I have to participate. And I participate through the stories I tell myself about what's going on. So today I get to do is I get to pick and choose the story I'm telling. It needs to be plausible. It shouldn't start with the Martians have landed. But at least a plausible story that has a quality element to it. Okay? A quality story. So this is where Bill gets real tricky, okay? If I'm doing this thing, I say, God, fix the son of a gun, okay? All right? I want the direct line from God down to that person to fix whatever is spiritually sick about them, not Bill's suggestion. This one is a little right angle kind of prayer. You ready for the right angle prayer? We ask God to help us show them. You get the idea? It's got to come through me. It's coming through me. It's not coming from God down under them. It's coming through me. This is about bearing witness to those I would help of thy power, thy love, and thy way of life, right? So we ask God to help us show them the same tolerance. It says pity here. I'm sorry, I think of empathy here as the definition rather than pity. For me, pity is me looking down on someone. I prefer to use empathy. That's me. And patience. Boy, we're back at patience, you know. Which if I have a new employer being all-powerful, he provides what I need as long as I stay close to him and perform. I got lots of time for patience, right? Because I'm at my destination. I'm not trying to get anywhere, so then I'll be happy. Because I'm in the spiritual experience, right? That's where I need to be. And if I'm in the spiritual experience, I get to show tolerance, empathy, and patience. Something I get to do as a result of this program and these actions. When a person offended, we said to ourselves, this is a sick man. How can I be helpful to him? Rather than, didn't say, how can I fix him? Do you notice? I love what the big book doesn't say. If I really focus on what it, I would have put in, you know, until he gets fixed, I can, you know. No, it says, how can I be helpful to him? God save me from being angry, thy will be done. Dana.
Yeah, you know, in the beginning of the big book, in the foreword to the first edition, it starts out on, and it says, many do not comprehend that the alcoholic is a very sick person, and besides, we are sure our way of life has the advantages of all. And, you know, if I can have love and tolerance and patience for and empathy or sympathy for another alcoholic, why can't I have that same for anybody else that's sick? You know, we have this sickness of addiction, and people... My sponsor says it all the time. I'd rather pray for him than be him. You know, I mean, it's, you know, it's a big thing. You know, and at the end of this, it says, "This is a sick man. How may I be helpful to him? God, save me from being angry. Thy will be done." That's the resentment prayer. That's the 4.5-step prayer right there. That's your resentment prayer. And there's a prayer for it. And I don't know. It takes the power out of it to me when I pray for somebody. When I look at somebody as sick versus just being a no good. Lying, cheating dog, you know, it's easier to stomach them because, you know, not everybody is practicing the principles and the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. Not everybody is living a life with good intentions, you know, and we have to deal with those people. And are we going to get resentful every time we have to deal with them, or are we going to pray for them and we're going to enjoy the serenity and the peace of mind that comes from doing that versus being angry with them? So it's a good way to look at it.
And forgiveness does not mean I condone the behavior. I like what Jesus said on the cross, forgive them for they know not what they do. See, if other people knew what we've learned to experience that have had these awakenings, if I'd have known back then when I was acting out so much what I know right now, I would not have behaved that way. If I'd have known the level of peace and serenity I'm able to find today, the way I'm living, I would never have done that. I know that today. So I can forgive others because they don't understand. And I knew in book form what I needed to do. I just didn't have the spiritual experience to go along with it. So on the next page, we avoid retaliation or argument. We wouldn't treat sick people that way. If we, you know, what I do is I think, you know, this person's bad behavior, I replace their bad behavior with perfect behavior, but they have 4-stage cancer, you know. How would I treat them? And that's when I really treat the behavior as a spiritual sickness. If I really can put it on the same plane as that, it becomes much easier to work with, to handle. So if we do, we destroy our chance of being helpful because, again, this is about being a giver rather than a user, right? The world gives to a giver. The world gets real tired of giving to a user. So we cannot be helpful to all people, but at least God will show us how to take a kindly and tolerant view of each and every one. There's always a better option to being taking a kindly and tolerant view. It's always one of the options. In the Course in Miracles, it says, I can choose peace over this. And I think that's one of the real powerful messages in that book.
You know, I used to love to live in chaos and drama. You know, that's where I used to live in that world. And now I want to wear a T-shirt that's got a circle with a red X through it that says drama because I hate drama. I avoid retaliation and argument like the plague because it doesn't bring me serenity. It's a miserable place to live. And then, you know, I think when it says at the end, a kindly and tolerant view of each and everyone, and it just doesn't say each and every other alcoholic. You know, there's other people that we deal with out there, as I mentioned earlier. You know, so it's that view of everything. So it's just a different way of thinking things. It's, you know, like we're doing something different with our lives. You know, we're acting a different way. We're living a different way. And we need to practice this stuff. Go ahead, Damien.
And one other thing is tolerance. I once took tolerance off of the list of principles because I thought I got it mixed up with tolerate. You know, I'll tolerate you until you get as good as me, and then I'll actually like you. It's not what Bill meant by tolerance, is my understanding today. It means there's something you know in some way of living that you know better how to do than I do. I just can't see it yet. You understand? That I don't know enough yet. And that's, I think, the larger definition of it's tolerance, not tolerate. So now we're at the back up to the spiral notebook, and I call this prayer and observation. And what I've done is to separate out 3 and 4 with this section on page 66 and 67 that we just read. I call this the pause, okay? So if I can get people to do prayer and observation in between columns 3 and column 4, then I can be really ready to do column 4, which is I can look at my own part. Once I've cleared my mind and gotten this idea that the maintenance and growth of my spiritual condition is where I want to go, I want to be kindly and tolerant. That's my first goal, not to get what I want, not to have people treat me well, not to have my rights. That's another thing Ann Smith said. She said about surrender. She said, surrender your rights. And I went, this is America. What are you talking about, surrender my rights, you know? And I got to do is I got to surrender my right to be upset. If I surrender my, boy, I tell you what, it has come back so many times, you know. It's sort of like the other great philosopher from the 20th century, Curly from the Three Stooges. You know? I was a victim of circumstance, you know. And victims don't last very long in this program, you know. We don't, you know, they just don't, I have to give up my victim status or I got to go find some place where somebody will listen to it. So that's what I do on this particular section. Here we have, go ahead, Dana, you can read. This is, by the way, we got a picture here of this cat looking through the glass at a squirrel who's holding flowers. So that's
referring to our list again, putting out of our minds the wrongs other had done. We resolutely look for our own mistakes. There's your next column. Okay? And it says, where have we been selfish, self-seeking, dishonest, or frightened? There's your next column. So now you've got all your columns laid out for you. Though the situation had not been entirely our fault, we tried to disregard the other persons involved entirely. Where were we to blame? The inventory was ours, not the other man's. When we saw our faults, we listed them. We placed them before us in black and white. We admitted our wrongs honestly and were willing to set these matters right. You know, it's not the other person that we're trying to fix here. You know, we're trying to fix ourselves. We're trying to, you know, look at our part in these things, and then we'll get into that when we make our amends and all that. There's clear-cut directions on how to do that. And but I like it because everything is laid out for you. Like I said, you know, we'll look at our own mistakes. What did we do? What did we start this ball rolling? I talked a little bit about this earlier. And I was just seeing if I had anything else on there. No, I'm good with that.
And you can have probably 6 or 7 columns in here, depending on how you want to lay it out. So Bill's got a whole bunch of different columns. I tend to group several of these questions into my mistakes. So that's what I put the column under. I call it my mistakes. I've got another reason for the last column that I use, and that's one that actually comes up back in the, is suggested in the sex inventory part. But what I put in here is the my mistakes. I just say dishonest, self-seeking, frightened. You know, where, and I like the where here. Bill uses it other places. Where means what conditions. We go back to our thing about causes and conditions. So a where are you right now? You could describe your condition a lot of different ways, right? You could physically describe what building we're in, also what kind of mood are you in, you know, all of these other kinds of things, but it's a where kind of condition. So under what conditions do I make these mistakes? And then what I get to do is watch for these conditions and then learn how to do that resentment prayer, to do forgiveness, to make amends, whatever I need to do in order to get back to the spiritual experience. Because that's my end goal, is the spiritual experience. Not to get my conditions the way I want them to get, because they will never get the way I want them to get. So that's the way I do it on that one. And the next one, what I do in the last one is I go, what should I have done instead? Now, I just do that because it's the same thing as you wind up with in the sex inventory piece. And it also tells me what principle I should have been practicing. I like the analogy of Dana's got an empty bottle of water over there. Okay? If I want to get all the air out of that bottle, what's the best way to do that? Fill it up, right? So if I try and suck the air out, I'm just going to crunch the bottle, right? And it's going to be very difficult. It takes a lot of energy. Easiest thing to do is fill it up. This is what I talk about with 6 and 7 and why 6 and 7 are very powerful. They tell me, for me, I give myself permission to never work on my character defects ever again. And this is the idea. A character defect is simply the failure to work a principle. So if I remove the character defect, I'm going to create a vacuum, and sucked into that vacuum is probably going to be another character defect. But if I fill the space up with tolerance, kindliness, forgiveness, you know, seeking God, all of those things, being a good father, being a good husband, doing those things, then I won't have time for character defects. They're still going to crop up. Believe me, they still crop up. But I won't have as much time for them. And I'll quickly recognize, see, I like this column for me, and that's just me, because I can show them what principle is involved here. And instead of working it on as a character defect later on, I can say which principles, and a list, because this is a moral inventory. What areas have I not been as moral as I needed to be? I need to forgive, I need to forgive, I need to forgive. And after a while you'll say, boy, I need to work on this forgiveness thing. You know, then I'm really working on something that will create a positive in my life. Whereas if I work on a character defect, I don't know what that produces, just another hole. You see, that's the beauty. We hand our character defects over to God. And the reason that is the unconscious mind for me. Anybody in here that has had the obsession to drink removed understands the power of having the unconscious mind not pop an idea into your head. How could I make that happen? I have no power over controlling what kind of things pop into my mind. But as I've done these things, less and less do those negative things or those bad behaviors pop into my mind. More and more often it's, how can I be helpful? More and more, that's the kind of thing that pops into my mind. So, but only God can do that. Only God can control my unconscious, as far as I'm concerned. What I can do is continue to practice these things, and I create the conditions in which God can remove them for me. Dana.
No, I mean, I echo everything that you said. You know, I mean, now you've got everything laid out, you know, and I like the what should I have done instead, you know, because as we start thinking and we start doing things, I think when we go through this, I think we say, well, what did I do? I could have done this, you know, and I think it's kind of important to look at that, you know, because now as we go through our lives, then you got to be thinking about, well, what can I do different? You know, it's always about what I can do different. So,
and if it's just a list of all the bad things I did, I'll go, God, because I've also seen guys look at that and go, I'm capable of doing that. Do you understand? They go, I could have done that. That would have been the easier way. I have the power to be able to, I can do that. And if we can get somebody to go, I can do that. Isn't that great? That's really when we got you then. You know, if I can get you to say, oh, I can do that. That's easy. You see, because we tried to find an easier, softer way, but we could not. You know why we couldn't? This is the easier, softer way. The St. Francis prayer on page 99 of the 12 and 12 is not a hard prayer to live by. It's a very difficult prayer to not live by. If where there's love, I bring hatred, or where there's hatred, I bring more hatred, that's a terrible way to live, you know? An eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth makes a very blind and toothless world, you know? What I need to do is where there is hatred, may I sow love. And I even like the idea of the Catholic version about sowing love, because that means that I go tell somebody else the good qualities about this person who doesn't think well of me. Not tell them, because if I'm telling them, I'm wanting an end result from them. I'm wanting them to like me. I'm going to change their behavior. But if I'm telling somebody else important in their life, and I've got examples, not enough time to go into them, but that works 100% of the time, when I start telling somebody else that, it changes me about that person. And it changes the whole, I don't need to tell them directly. This idea of sowing these loves, doing these things, the St. Francis prayer, a very powerful prayer. So here we are, and we're going to take... Can we gonna take a 5-minute break? Let's try and do five, because we're going to try and do fear and sex and do it fast. Okay? So it's 4:17 right now. We'll come